It is clear then that the Enlightenment had what I talked about last time, both a view of the autonomy of man and a quest for authority. And that is the point I tried to make last time with this kind of dialectic between the autonomy of man and the idea of authority. Now, the idea of the autonomy of man was based on the concept of reason. And reason, again, was based on doubt. In other words, on the kind of thing that Pierre Bayle had done. That is the critical mind, asking certain questions. Certain questions which were to attack and meant to demolish the monopoly of Christianity over thought, over attitudes, over life, which I tried to do last time with Pierre Bayle, you may remember, and make clear to you what these questions were. And this kind of emphasis on reason was to produce a new kind of man, a new kind of man of whom Nathan is a good example, or Emile. You will read about two of these new kind of men, Nathan and Emile, men, not women. We come to women later. Men, that is very important, because in Emile you will see that Rousseau proposes a totally different education for women, an education that will keep women subservient very largely. So that tells you something else. It's the new man who has reason. It's the new man as yet who stands in the foreground. This new man was supposed to contradict Pascal. That is to say, he was to comprehend the universe not by a leap of Christian faith, not through the mediation of Christ, through Christ's function of salvation, but he was to understand the universe through his reason. Now, how is reason defined? And here I will go with you to Nathan, which is the best way, and to the beginning of Nathan, that dialogue right at the beginning between Daya, the nursemaid, who stands for superstition, Christianity, and all of that, and Nathan. And there is one passage here. It is Act 1, Scene 1. I have to do it this way because you may all have different kinds of editions. So Act 1, Scene 1 is very important because Daya defends revealed religion, but she defends revealed religion as dreaming. It's dreaming, and Nathan opposes dreaming. Against dreaming, he puts up reason. No dreaming. He says, her dreaming is so sweet. And Nathan says, no dreaming. For the idea of reason here is clear. It is the idea of reason which comes down to us, as I said last time, but I want to repeat, from Descartes in the 17th century, namely the idea that clear and distinct ideas is what is the essence of reason, and that therefore reason can be defined mathematically. That mathematics is the best expression of reason. That will remain. That's the reason why here in the University of Wisconsin, by the way, you have a choice between language and mathematics. You have to take mathematics. Because the idea in this retarded United States, which is still an Enlightenment country, thank God, I'm an Enlightenment man myself. So an Enlightenment country, the idea is that mathematics is important because it's the essence of reason. Now, that is Descartes. Now, why clear and distinct ideas? The queen, therefore, of sciences is no longer theology. The queen of sciences is mathematics. And within mathematics, geometry. For Descartes, the queen was geometry. Now, mathematics and geometry, clear and distinct ideas expressed clearly and distinctly. That must be clear in clear and distinct language. The result was a belief in the autonomy of knowledge, because knowledge is based on clear and distinct ideas. Anyone with the appropriate education, of course, can have clear and distinct ideas. Anyone can have knowledge. Therefore, the universe can be known by anybody with education, anybody who has clear and distinct ideas. You see the optimism of education. You see again how our United States system is built on that. Anybody can know this. Anybody with the right education can have clear and distinct ideas. The education of Emile, of course. Clear and distinct ideas. And therefore, there is the possibility of knowledge. As somebody said in the 18th century, our century will leave nothing undiscovered. The great enthusiasm. And that enthusiasm was enshrined in one of the most famous products of the Enlightenment, the famous encyclopedia. The famous encyclopedia. Now, encyclopedias were new in this regard, and this is the first, edited by Diderot. The famous encyclopedia, edited by Diderot during the years of 1751 to 1756 in the middle. Now, that's a new idea, because encyclopedias depend on the idea that the universe can be known through clear and distinct ideas. And the idea of the encyclopedia is if you discover everything man has discovered through his reason, then you know the universe. The encyclopedia was to give you the key to the knowledge of the universe, the autonomy of knowledge. There is nothing here about man's limitation by original sin. There is nothing here about Adam and Eve and the fall from paradise. Man can know. Man must know through clear and distinct ideas. It is the universe of Newton. Knowledge is intelligible. There is here, obviously, no place for the burning bush or any direct communication with God as there was before. This is the introduction to the encyclopedia written by Diderot. To collect all knowledge scattered over the face of the earth, to present its general outlines and structure to the men with whom we live, and to transmit that to those who will come after us, so that the work of the past centuries may be useful, and notice useful, I'll come back to that, to the following centuries, that our children, by becoming more educated, may at the same time become more virtuous and happier, and that we may not die without having deserved well of the human race. In other words, you see something I'll talk about more, the linkage of education and virtue. The linkage of education and virtue. Why? Because educated, you will get clear and distinct ideas. You will use your reason. And the path through virtue is through the use of reason and through the repudiation of irrationalism, of passions, of all of that sort of thing, through the use of the critical mind. And thus, Diderot goes on to say in another passage of the encyclopedia as follows. We have seen that our encyclopedia could only have been the endeavor of a philosophical century, that this age has dawned, and that fame, while raising to immortality the names of those who will perfect man's knowledge in the future, will perhaps not disdain to remember our own selves. In other words, this is the philosophical century, this tremendous optimism now, that we have discovered the clue to the universe, the clue to life, and this is the century in which we will have fame, and because, after all, we are putting together the clues to the universe. I have said, says Diderot, that it could only belong to a philosophical age to attempt an encyclopedia. Here you see what an encyclopedia is. It could only belong to a philosophical age to attempt an encyclopedia. And I have said this because such a work constantly demands more intellectual daring than is commonly found in past ages. All things must be examined, debated, investigated, without exception, and without regard for anyone's feelings. We must ride roughshod over all the ancient puerilities, overturn the barriers that reason never erected, give back to the arts and sciences the liberty that is so precious to them. We have for quite some time needed a reasoning age when men would no longer seek the rules in classical authors, but in nature, when men would be conscious of what is false and true. And I take the name false and true to mean to use his reason. There you have it, I think, very good, very well, that you have here this idea of reason, the clear and distinct ideas, and you have it once more stressed in your reading in Emile, page 153. I'll give you the page because there we use the same thing, I think. In page 153, Emile, where it is said, always remember that the spirit of my instruction is not to teach the child many things, but to allow only true and clear ideas to enter his mind. Now, all of this has a certain practicality. It's supposed to be useful. Knowledge is never abstract because it is the clue to the universe. It is obviously useful knowledge. It must be useful. It's a clue to the universe. A kind of practicality. This is the age when arts and crafts become revived and to the foreground. A kind of practicality is in demand. The practical will be important. And this is presupposed by Lessing, by Voltaire, Voltaire's famous phrase, "We must cultivate our own garden." That famous phrase, the end phrase of his Candide, really means we must be practical. We must be activists. We must not be contemplative. That is what really means. We must cultivate our own garden. And of course, and I don't want to say this now because I'll come back to it, that is the essence of the climax of Nathan, the three-ring story. The famous story at the end about, I'll say much more about that later. The climax is that everything must be judged by its effects, by virtue, by practical test, and not by the test of contemplation or theology, but by the practical test of reason. And yet you might quite rightly say, clear and distinct ideas is a vague idea. I mean, if we all asked ourselves, or asked him, you know, his clear and distinct ideas and mine are obviously quite different. Mine are geometrical, his are rock and roll. So that we have quite different kind of ideas. And here I come to, of course, the crux of the matter, the presupposition that nobody would have different ideas. Now that is, in a way, the tyranny of the Enlightenment, but the presupposition. On what is this based? It is based, first of all, and this I can illustrate from Nathan. Very well, again, I think Act 1, Scene 1, no, Act 1, Scene 2. Nathan says, again, talking to Daya, the superstitious Christian, he says, "And don't the same causes produce the same effects? And therefore, there can no longer be miracles." And that is the sense. First of all, it is based on a view of nature, which is a determinate view of nature, Newton's view of nature, that cause produces effect. And of course, when Newton found that the sunspots didn't, he appealed to God to correct it, because the whole idea of Descartes falls down. Because there cannot be chaos. Our ideas must all be alike. That's clear, yes? They must all be clear and distinct. Our definition of clear and distinct must be alike. And it is based, first of all, that The same cause always has the same effect. And I'm not teaching the next cultural history, but you will see the terrible bind it brought culture in when you get the new physics in the end of the 19th century, which no longer believes that the same cause produces the same effect. And then you get the uncertainty principle, and that will upset the whole universe. But at the moment, we are still in the Newtonian universe, where this is true. But secondly, I go to Nathan again. Even that doesn't answer it. So why does the same cause always produce the same effect? And here, the Templar says, the Templar, Act 1, Scene 5. The Templar, who is already having doubts about Christianity, expresses his doubts as follows. No, no, my friend, nature doesn't lie. God doesn't contradict himself in his own works. Now that then is the second. Nature never lies. God does not contradict himself in his own works. And of course, cause and effect, they thought they could discover by the investigation of nature. The beauty of God in the flea. Nature does not lie. The seasons are seasons. Spring, summer, winter, no matter what. The seasons are the seasons. The organs are the organs. But that isn't enough. So why doesn't nature lie? Because God doesn't allow it to lie. And in the end, you come back to God. You come back to God. You always come back to God. And you come back to God in a spectacular analogy, a famous analogy of the Enlightenment. One day, Diderot was sitting at a fire together with the leading atheists, or the leading man whose name I will just don't bother you with anymore, but who wanted to be a real atheist, not to believe in God at all. And they argued, does God exist? And Helvetius said, no, God doesn't exist. What nonsense. And then he took a piece of fire, a piece of wood, and lit from it another piece of wood, and said, look, there is no need for God. And Diderot said, but somebody has to invent the fire. So that is the Enlightenment idea. God invents the fire, but after that, he does nothing more. Now, we don't put it that way. The Enlightenment didn't put it that way. But what we call deism, from the Latin deus, that is, God is essential, as he was for Descartes. Descartes had to face, too, why do we all have clear, distinct ideas? God wouldn't let us have anything else but clear, distinct ideas. But the Enlightenment, which went further, for whom reason was the clue to unravel the riddle of the universe, he had to go one step further, the Enlightenment. God expressed himself. How did God express himself? Through what the Enlightenment called the laws of nature. The laws of nature. And here I come to the first authority. I said the Enlightenment will have three authorities to which it comes back. The laws of nature, the classics, and history. And I am now coming to the first. The laws of nature, which in a way is the most important or the most fundamental. Because in a sense, the clear and distinct ideas, everything else, depends on it. Clarity, the search for clarity. And before I come to the law of nature, I want to make one more remark. The search for clarity here comes, of course, again in an age of industrialization, in the age of the growing speed of time, yes? So there is a quest for clarity. And eventually, when I come to the classics, this great enthusiasm for the rediscovery of classical sculpture, this great idea of the new male beauty, the classical beauty, is because, again, it is clean cut, it is clean. And you get, therefore, not only intellectually with the laws of nature, with clear and distinct ideas. You get entering our society the idea that somehow virtue is connected with clean-cutness. And clean-cutness will be Greek sculpture, the model of Greek sculpture. I dare say if these rediscovered green sculptures, I'll come back to that later, had beards and long hair, your parents would never object to beards and long hair. But as these Greek sculptors in the 18th century didn't have beards and long hair, but were clean cut, as you probably know, therefore it is again part of this search for clarity, part of this search for clarity. And so the very male beauty, if you like, the very idea of beauty, not only male beauty, national beauty, everything, the nation represents itself that way, is clean cut. So it all goes together, this ideal of beauty and the ideal of the laws of nature. Now these laws of nature, therefore, make the universe harmonious. And in order for us to have the same clean-cut thought, geometry and mathematics can't vary. 2 times 2 is 4, yes? You can't vary it, but you have to have a theory of why it doesn't vary. You have to lock it into place. And what locks it into place, therefore, are the laws of nature, a universe based on harmony. But there are 2 kinds of natural laws. One is an obvious one, applies, if you like, to scientific discovery, to Newton's universe, to the way a flea is constructed, to human biology. That is to say, through scientific discovery. That's simple. They decide if you were a scientist, if you discovered, if new mathematical formulations, or you dissected this and that, you would discover the laws of God. The laws of God as in a flea, as I cited to you, Swammerdam. Swammerdam was the greatest zoologist of his time in the 18th century. The beauty of God as seen in a flea. That's his title. So the beauty of God is through his natural laws, and once you dissect a flea and get the workings of a flea, or the workings of anything, the workings of the human body, you will see cause follows effect, and you have all of these things. And you must remember that you are on a certain stage of scientific discovery here. Now that's one, and that's very simple. That's Helvetius and the fire. But there's a second natural law, and that is more complex, and that must concern us, because the new man makes scientific investigation. He becomes imbued with the beauty of God, but he must also become virtuous. And virtuous is an inner quality. And how do you get virtuous? Because there is a second law of nature, the law of virtue, the moral law. And the moral law is within yourself. And it is obviously more difficult to discuss or to get hold of than, let us say, the kind of law of the beauty of God in a flea. That must be, I think, quite clear to you. The moral law is not so easy. Voltaire, and I cite Voltaire on this. What is natural law? Question. What is natural law? Answer. The instinct which makes us feel justice. Question. What do you call just and unjust? Answer, what appears so to the entire universe. In other words, virtue, justice, and injustice are given. We don't really have to discuss them. They are given. Everybody knows what is just and unjust. They presuppose that. Everybody knows it. It's a natural law that comes from God, but it's a natural law which in a sense comes close to common sense. You will see that in Nathan, which is all about that, in a sense. It is universal. Everybody, in a way, knows it. Now, Voltaire goes further. He tries to give examples. Show me, he says, a country where it is honorable to rob me of the fruit of my toil, to break one's promises, to lie in order to hurt, to calumniate, to assassinate, to poison, to be ungrateful towards a benefactor, to beat one's father and one's mother when they offer you food. In other words, He gives obvious examples that people have sort of an instinctual knowledge of what is virtuous, because that's about all you can say about the natural law of virtue. It becomes, in a way, very vague. But it is also essential to your reading in Emile. Very essential to your reading in Emile. Page 83, yeah? And moral training. Moral training. Read that very carefully. Because Emile is trained to distinguish justice from injustice, to be virtuous. He's trained to be virtuous. And so he gives instances of examples. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And these examples of virtuous people, if I could ever have doubted that there's an innate sense of right and wrong implanted in the human heart. So there's an innate sense of right and wrong. And in Emile's education, the problem is to bring out this innate sense. And this is, of course, the idea of the Enlightenment, so strong in Rousseau, I'll come to it again in a minute, that man is virtuous. Man is inherently virtuous. And therefore, if you beat your mother and father for giving you food, I wouldn't put past some of you, if you beat your mother and father for giving you food, then it's a corrupt world which has made you corrupt. Does that remind you of something? Uh-huh. Rousseau is still alive, of course. So it has made you corrupt. The world has made you corrupt, yes? The world has made you. You are not corrupt. You are good because you are born according to the natural law, and through the right education and the right environment. So you will see from Emile and Nathan, from the right education and right environment, everyone can be virtuous. Everyone has clear and distinct ideas. The natural law works for everyone, everyone alike. And therefore, if we are not virtuous, if our society is corrupt, it is society that has made men corrupt, and the environment that has made men corrupt, and education, the wrong education that has made men corrupt, not the education. Emile. Now, there is no argument about that. It's taken as granted. And what has made man corrupt is Christianity. If we live in a corrupt world where men steal and lie, where men don't have distinct and clear ideas, where education is corrupted with theology, the reason is Christianity. And the Christian patriarch in Nathan is the example. Read carefully what the Christian patriarch says in Nathan. The Christian patriarch is the example of a corrupt society which must be overthrown. Now, clearly, this deism is a need for authority. This deism is a need for authority. These laws of nature come from God. They have their own life. Voltaire's famous analogy, God is a clockmaker. He makes the clock, but then he retires. And the clock ticks on. And what ticks on are the natural laws, both inherent in man and external, which man can grasp with his clear and distinct ideas. Now, what result does it have for the new man? Well, obviously, those are least corrupt who live closest to the natural laws. Those are least corrupt who live most outside a corrupt society. And so you get the Enlightenment's quest for what we would call the noble savage. It is both Montesquieu's discovery of some, what he thought was a wild man in the woods of Hanover, but that is less interesting for us at the minute, than the Enlightenment's great authority, the discovery of the American Indian and of the Mexican Indian, the discovery of primitive man. At first, the discovery of primitive man as a revelation, as something that is much to be praised and admired. I remind you that the main book that Emile reads is Robinson Crusoe. that there is, as you will see in Rousseau, this long passage, that is the best education, because Robinson Crusoe lives in nature, uncorrupted by the world. But I want to give you two more examples of this. A drama, for example, about a Mexican Indian, a drama directed against Spain, against the Spaniards, of course, has this to say, an English drama of 1748, about the Mexican Indians, a race of men unlettered and untaught, strangers to science, yet with virtue fraught. No school had they of philosophic pride, and simple reason was their only guide. That reason in the paths of nature trod, and worshipping the sun, they meant a god. In other words, their sun worship is really deism. Free from the ills in polished life that spring and gold with them was a neglected thing. So you have the sort of noble savage, the noble savage. One more example from a play called An Aztec Tragedy, Montezuma. That's the name of this play of 1778. And here Cortez, the conqueror, becomes a friend of the Indians. And he has to say this about the Indians in this play, Montezuma. Savage and wild are terms we give to fashions not our own. Better, perhaps, that man had yet been left to the rude dictates of his native virtue than to be wrought and polished into vice by arts too much refined. Now, I think that makes it quite clear to you. This worship of the primitive. Similarly, the rediscovery of Africa and of the blacks. At first, they thought they had rediscovered the noble savage. And there was a great enthusiasm at first about blacks. That will not last, as you will see. But the enthusiasm for American Indians will last, whether they are the Indians of North America or South America. And it will be climaxed with 1790, when the chiefs of the 10 Indian tribes of the Dakotas visited Europe, made a triumphal tour in Europe in full dress, of course. And everybody thought they had met the original noble savages. And they were fated from one end to Europe to another as the heads of the 10 Indian tribe. Now, this will remain. This will remain very strong in Europe. Very strong, this idea of the North American Indian, of Indian liberation. I myself was brought up on it. The only reason I came to America was to see an Indian. And I remember the great thrill I had when I saw my first Indian on some darned reservation in North Dakota, I think, yes. Yes, I gave a talk in North Dakota. That was thrilling, nothing but Indian. I still have that romanticism. It's a typically European romanticism. Hitler had the same romanticism, I must tell you. He was always for liberation of the Indian. Hitler, that was, everybody had it, because it's the noble savage. It was sort of the kind of accord of a European with original virtue. And you have the same thing then in these dramas of the 18th century, in this tour of the heads of the tribes of 1790, and in the battle dress, and of course one played cowboys and Indians. We all played that in Europe as children. And the villains were the cowboys. The heroes were the Indians. Always, always, always. I was always an Indian, never a cowboy. So what you have there is clear. You have, in other words, a reversal of what's true here, of course, because we have been the oppressors and exterminators of the Indians. That's something different. In Europe, they connected with this quest. Now, this quest then for native virtue will not remain, will not really remain, because in the end, it will, in a sense, it will change. For what you will have in the end is something else asserting itself, the power of reason. And the fact that to understand the universe, You have to be educated. And so in the end, this primitivism will be mitigated by the idea that human progress is from primitive to abstract thought. In the second half of the 18th century, that becomes extremely important, that progress is from primitive thought to abstract thought, because abstract thought is obviously a necessity for geometry, mathematics, clear and distinct ideas. So you have the progression from primitive to abstract thought. And Fontenelle, for example, a famous theoretician of the second half of the 18th century, says that the primitive mind is atavistic, peasant dolts and fibbing children. Or the English philosopher Hume, abstract mind is the mind of reason. And the result was rather fatal for blacks, because in the end, blacks were put with children. Primitive thought were children, and so eventually you get all these ideas that blacks don't advance over children of 15, which were very important in the beginning of racism, that blacks are really children, and therefore they must be ruled like children. And that comes from the idea that the primitive mind is the mind of children. Doesn't mean they have to be exterminated. Nobody ever wanted that. That's quite a misconception. Early racism had nothing to do with extermination. They were children, and they have to be treated like children. So that they have to be treated like children, because, after all, the progress is from primitive to abstract mind. So in the second half of the 18th century, if you like, the implications of the emphasis on reason come out, yes? They come out, and they work to mitigate this admiration of the noble savage. The admiration of the noble savage. But there are two remarks that I want to do in summarizing what I have said. First of all, that throughout the Enlightenment, the idea will remain that man is virtuous, of course, originally, and that society, Rousseau's idea, as you will see, that present society may have to be abolished. We have to go back to the beginnings, to start anew in order to get a real society, because our society is hopelessly corrupted, and man with it. So we have to overthrow our society, abolish it root and branch, Rousseau's idea, and start again from scratch. That will remain. And the second thing that will remain is not the admiration of the primitive. There were in Europe no primitives. This savage of the Wood of Hanover, nobody knows who he was, probably some poor lost soul or hermit or something. But the only people in Europe who qualified were the peasants. And so you get the beginning of something very strong in European history, the worship of the peasant. The peasant lives through nature. Working close to nature restores your virtue. Where else do you think this ridiculous and idiotic notion comes from, that working on the land makes you specially good? I mean, I worked on the land, and potatoes made me specially evil, because I worked in a kibbutz once in that smell of dung. There's nothing to write home about, as we would say. But in our society, it is very deep. The more man destroys nature, of course, the more he becomes devoted to nature. And so the more we destroy nature left and right, the more this worship of the peasant, the more this idea is that you work on the land, you really are virtuous. But here it begins. The peasant is the only noble savage we have, in a way. He's close to the land. He's outside society. He may not be quite corrupted as all the other parts of society. And so you get in the end it kind of perverted, that the corruption is where the government is, or the seat of government. Berlin or Paris or London is the seat of corruption, and the seat of virtue is the countryside. The village is the seat of virtue, but God knows what goes on in a village. Have you ever followed these murder trials in Wisconsin? Gee. Anyway, you know. Anyhow, that's the legend, that's the theory, in which many of you, of course, believe, though you may laugh. Now, you really do think that working on the land makes you more virtuous, stronger, and more of an ideal type. It does make you more of an ideal type, because that will all come together. The clean-cutness, the work on the land, the repudiation of the city, that will all be an integral part of nationalism in the end. That's quite true. But at the moment, we are sowing the seeds. So that, first of all, as part of this natural law and this new man, you have Nathan as the new man, Emil as the new man, but eventually the new man will be the peasant, in a sense, the ideal peasant. And you get a whole peasant novel starts now, the peasant literature, together with the novel on Indians. The American Indian novel starts in Europe in the late 18th century. The American Indian novel, you get now the peasant novel. And of course, that goes stronger and stronger the more Europe is urbanized and industrialized, and the more nature is destroyed, the more man wants to go back to the land. Secondly, what we have here is something slightly different, namely an ambivalence about society. Now, Rousseau believed, and Diderot believed, that man becomes truly virtuous only in society. In other words, they did mitigate this admiration for the primitive, that there must be progress. Remember, the century believed in progress. There must be progress, though it only becomes obvious in society. In other words, they always had the problem of somehow linking primitivism to progress. And to link primitivism to progress, you say it's better to go from a primitive mind to an abstract mind. That is progress. But at the same time, you say from primitivism to society, the right kind of society, of course, not the wrong kind of society. And again, Diderot does it. And Diderot, in a famous book called The Nun, I'll come back to it from another angle. It's the first book ever written about lesbianism. Diderot's Nun makes it quite clear against the church, against convents. It's a book against convents. What else? The church and what he thinks goes on in convents. Man is born, he says, for life in society. Separate him, isolate him, and his ideas will go to pieces. His character will go sour. 100 ridiculous affections will spring up in his heart. Extravagant notions will take root in his mind like tares in the wilderness. For if poverty degrades us, segregation depraves us. So, in other words, man is made for society in the last resort. In spite of all this worship for primitivism, and man isolated, as in convents, here in convents, gets all sorts of notions. His passions run away. He comes to stand outside the, or she in this case, comes to stand outside the norms of society. For everything I've said today is what we call in German so nicely a double-edged sword. A double-edged sword. Why is it a double-edged sword? Because on the one end, you have the autonomy of man, man's reason, Nathan. I'm going to ask you what you think about Nathan the Wise eventually. Some of you already told me you love it. That's very odd, you know. That's a cultural thing. You may love it or not. I'd be very interested. When I teach it in Jerusalem, they hate it. But here you love it. It's a cultural condition thing. It's very interesting. We'll come back to that. But anyway, there is Nathan on the one hand. There is Nathan. That's quite clear. And I don't know what you will think of Nathan eventually. On the one hand, the autonomous man. There is Emil, the man with a critical mind. But on the other hand, there is what I like to call the underside of the Enlightenment, the penchant towards classification, which goes with mathematics, which goes with the new science of anthropology, which comes out of the Enlightenment. Talk about that later, and you read. The penchant towards classifying people. and the penchant towards conformity, because the basis is the natural law, the harmonious universe. God, who in Nathan the Wise it says, wouldn't have contradictory ideas. It can't vary the natural law. So that you have again a kind of dialectic. On the one end you have a very good, or however you want to put it, idea of the autonomy of man and the autonomy of man's reason. But on the other hand, you have a trend towards conformity. And that will make it clear why two things start in the Enlightenment. Two, on the face of it, contradictory things. But there are no contradictions in history. Everything is in a dialectical relationship. Two things start in the Enlightenment and as part of the Enlightenment, not as part of the Christian revival, as part of the Enlightenment. One is liberalism and the other is racism. And both start in the Enlightenment. And you can see now why both start in the Enlightenment. This inherent contradiction between the critical mind on the one hand and the need for conformity and classification on the other. There is this kind of contradiction. On the one hand, it's the aid of toleration. Not only freedom for American Indians, it's the time when the Jews were emancipated, the only minority in Europe. It's the time eventually when in certain parts slavery will be abolished. It is the age of emancipation, no doubt about it, no doubt about it. But on the other hand, at the same age, others will be re-enslaved, above all blacks. It's the age, if you like, of the re-enslavement of blacks. But it is also the age of the emancipation of Jews. It has this kind of contradictory tone to it, partly because of conformity, mostly, and the new sciences. Well, you read about, when you read in the towards the final solution there, those first chapter, the new sciences, anthropology, above all, which springs out of this need for clear and distinct ideas as far as people are concerned. And clear and distinct ideas as far as people is concerned presupposes virtue. But a virtue that is unanimous, and unanimous virtue can be quite repressive, you know. Unanimous virtue can be quite repressive. If we all agree what virtuous is, then those people who don't agree are, of course, not virtuous. Can be a very, again, a double-edged sword, yes? An idea of virtue, on the one hand, which we agree on, and on the other hand, the penchant for classification. For mathematics is classification, geometry is classification, so why not people themselves? Now, on Wednesday, you will hear about the education of the new man, and next Monday, I will talk about the new authorities, the classics, then, and history.